This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Bunker. My name is Nick Cohen, and in these series of podcasts, we're talking to authors who've come out with books we think are worth reading, are interesting, and indeed worth talking about. And I am delighted, absolutely delighted, to welcome broadcaster, thinker, campaigner Gavin Essler, who has... It's just out now, I think, Gavin, your new book, isn't it?
Yes, it's just out in the last couple of weeks, How Britain Ends. So... Lovely title.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, can I just get going with a line of yours that is on the front cover of the edition I've got? It may have been approved, but it goes to the heart of your absolutely excellent book, I should say, before I start questioning you about it. It says, I've lived in Edinburgh, Belfast, Cardiff and London. Our union has survived Scottish, Welsh and Irish nationalism. In How Britain Ends, I want to explain why the UK cannot survive English nationalism. Can I take that in two parts? First of all, why do you think that what we are seeing with the Brexit and post-Brexit movement is English, specifically English nationalism?
I think there are competing nationalisms, Nick, on these islands. And Scottish and Irish nationalism and Welsh nationalism have been studied and talked about for a very long time. But English nationalism has always been the dog that didn't bark. And in fact, you know, I've had some people commenting on the book saying, we English aren't nationalistic. That's why we're better than other people, which I thought was quite amusing. But there is clearly a trend of English nationalism, and you can see it, you can measure it. There have been opinion polls about it over the past 20 years. The IPPR, the Institute of Public Policy Research, and others have commented on it. And, you know, there's nothing bad about it. You notice perhaps the St. George's flag that used to be in some football grounds, and actually many English people that I know were slightly embarrassed about it. That's come out, and you see it in housing estates and elsewhere, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. What is different is that Englishness and Britishness have tended to be elided, tended to be the same thing or confused. And again, you know, 84% of the population of the United Kingdom is English, so it's hardly surprising this should be the case. But more recently, and particularly after Brexit, it would appear that England is going one way and Scotland and Northern Ireland in particular, and to a lesser extent Wales, may be going another way. The tectonic plates are shifting is really what I'm saying.
Right. Well, if I were a Brexiter, I would say to you, hold on a second. We fought Brexit as, if you want to call us nationalists, let's just assume for a moment they accept the word nationalist and face reality. As British nationalists, we wanted sovereignty for the all-British Westminster Parliament. We didn't do it for England. The Welsh voted by a majority for Brexit. There were substantial minorities in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Why do you say this is specifically English rather than British nationalism?
Because, for example, it's certainly true that some people in Scotland voted to leave the EU, but the majority didn't. And in Northern Ireland, the same is the case. And when I've been to those places, when people ask, who speaks for the United Kingdom now? Who is the voice that we would trust that defines what the United Kingdom might be in the future? It's certainly not UKIP. It's certainly not Nigel Farage. And it's not Boris Johnson either. And in fact, in Northern Ireland, I've had people saying, you know, after 5 minutes with Leo Varadkar, the Prime Minister of the Irish Republic in October 2019, Boris Johnson threw 100 years of unionism under the bus, and or into the Irish Sea, perhaps one should say. And Mrs. Thatcher said Northern Ireland is as British as Finchley. Boris Johnson has made it as British as France in customs terms. And in Scotland, the same, you get the same argument. So even though Nigel Farage had the UKIP party, the United Kingdom Independence Party, it didn't travel very well. It didn't really speak for the United Kingdom as it is. And it, Boris Johnson is the same. And so when he goes to Scotland, I've had two prominent Tories in the last 10 days tell me they die inside when the Prime Minister of our country comes there because they don't think he's good for the union.
I'm very glad you mentioned the border in the Irish Sea. I mean, it's a sign of, if you like, English nationalism or English insularity or English complacency, that that did not cause astonishment because he has effectively partitioned the United Kingdom by putting that border there.
Absolutely right. In Northern Ireland, I was there in October 2019 in Belfast. I go there quite a lot. I love the place. And I'm hanging out with unionists mostly. Or people of a unionist background. And they were absolutely astonished and incensed by this. And the Democratic Unionist Party has led them into a blind alley. That's a real problem because they voted against every single kind of Brexit that was put on the table in Parliament, but they're still in favour of Brexit. And that's where we are.
Hugo Rifkind of The Times made this point very well recently, that Remainers, of all people, ought to be against an independent Scotland because Remainers, well, people supported Remain for lots of different reasons. Just people voted Leave for lots of different reasons. But one of them is simply this, is there is a belief in as many as people as possible should have economic security and a good life. And Brexit is going to make people unemployed, it's going to reduce living standards, it's going to reduce the tax base for the NHS and schools and every other institution we depend on. Scottish independence would do that in spades. It would be Brexit on steroids. And yet, there's a feeling among English liberals, English leftists, that Scottish nationalism is a nice nationalism, civic nationalism, as you say, and you shouldn't really warn about its dangers. And then there's, I think ever since 2016, there's a bit of, well, we told you so feeling that Brexit is such a dangerous thing. It could lead to the breakup of the UK, which I agree it could. But in some ways, we're not going to go out and campaign to protect people's jobs in Glasgow and Motherwell and Dundee.
Well, you began that by saying Hugo Rifkind, the writer I really admire, in The Times said Remainers should be against Scottish independence. But not Scottish Remainers. Scottish Remainers.
Oh, I know. Oh, absolutely.
Scottish Remainers are the vote up for grabs for the SNP. You know, they're the ones that feel really angry that they've been dragged out of the EU against their will. And the reason why Ireland is important is a couple of things about that. You know, Ireland got independence under the worst possible circumstances, or at least 26 counties did, in 1922, after the World War One, as a result of the Easter Rising, a terrible mess. And Ireland was pretty backward, let's be blunt, for many years. Since 1973, being part of the European Union, there has been an Irish economic miracle. I don't fall for the Celtic Tiger stuff, but their GDP per capita is greater than that of the United Kingdom now, and it wasn't in 1973. So I know a lot of Scots who did not want independence. These are personal friends of mine who voted against independence, who have changed their minds because they see a future in the EU and they don't see a future connected to the kind of government that Boris Johnson is running in London. I agree there are lots of problems with it, and tearing up a union of 400 years is going to be much more difficult than Brexit. And that's my challenge to nationalists. But my challenge to unionists of different types is, so what are you actually offering? What is the offer that keeps the United Kingdom together? It's not Protestantism, it's not empire, it's not war, which are the three pillars of the past. What is it for the future? And to say, take our country back is just not an offer for the future, is it? It's exactly the opposite.
I entirely agree. I mean, I Scottish friends who voted against independence, and part of the deal was, we are voting to stay in the United Kingdom as part of the European Union.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Johnson tore up that deal. And I'm not remotely surprised that they are furious. But the logic of what you're saying is, and we'll go on to your proposals in your book, I read your proposals, and perhaps it's a good time to talk about it, about home rule, about refashioning of institutions, and so on. But the logic of, politically, it strikes me at any rate, the logic of what you say is the United Kingdom is in mortal danger as long as the Conservatives are in power.
Yeah, and it's not just me saying it. There are two Scottish Conservatives, you would know their names, I'm not going to say them on the, with you now, two prominent Scottish Conservatives who in the past 2 weeks have both said to me, the only hope for the union is a Labour government. Now, I laughed when the first one said it, and when the second one said it, I thought, my goodness, they are really, really in desperate trouble if that's what they think. And they do think that. And that's why when Boris Johnson goes to Scotland, the SNP complain publicly but are privately delighted, and why the Conservatives say, oh, it's nice to see the Prime Minister, and die inside, because they think he, as George Osborne said, he could go down in history as the worst Prime Minister ever, worse than Lord North, who lost the American colonies. And I agree with that. I think that could happen.
Well, I'm going to try and put an English nationalist point of view to you, but I was always, I keep quoting, probably I overquote, an opinion poll that YouGov did when Brexit was snarled up in the Commons and Theresa May's premiership was dying as she tried to get something through. It was done off Conservative members, I think it was. And YouGov put to them, what would you sacrifice for Brexit? Would you sacrifice the United Kingdom in terms of keeping Scotland? Oh, yeah. Would you allow Northern Ireland to go into a United Ireland? Oh, yeah, that's fine. You know, and so the same, but you could say the same passions that motivate Scottish nationalism, motivate English nationalism, because a Scottish nationalist wouldn't, you know, if you say to him, but you'll lose, there'll be a border on the Tweed. There's no loss for them in the union with England. They want it. And the same applies to English nationalists. And what argument? Because I'm of a certain age, because I have a Scottish mother, you know, I hate the idea of a border on the Tweed. I find it repulsive. You know, my mother would suddenly become an alien when she was in England, and I would be an alien when I'm in Glasgow. I mean, I dislike it for the same reason I dislike Brexit so much. But for an English nationalist, what would be your argument against them? You put proposals to save the union. What would you say to an English nationalist who said, but we don't want it anymore?
I think you ask an absolutely central question. And I think the difference is that Scots have thought about this for, well, certainly 30 years in different ways, as indeed have people in Northern Ireland for 100 years in different ways. And many people in Wales have thought about it. But actually, the complacency in England about this is part of the reason I wrote the book, which is, do you realise, as a result of Brexit, and the result that will follow could be Scottish independence, there will be problems for Scotland, because what does it really mean to be independent in a clearly interdependent world on an interdependent island? But what does it mean for England? Suddenly, not to be the UK's permanent representative on the P5 of the permanent five of the UN Security Council. Because why would England still have that seat when it was given to the United Kingdom? The parallel with Russia, the collapse of the Soviet Union is obvious, that Russia had to ask to be part of the P5, and of course it was granted. Would England, seriously, when there are a lot of other people? What would England be doing with the nuclear submarine fleet from Faslane? Would it be in the, you know, Dartford or somewhere up the Thames estuary? You know, what would England's, to go back to the big question that was once asked in the 1960s by the US Secretary of State at the time, you know, what is post-imperial Britain's role in the world? Well, it wouldn't even be post-imperial Britain. It would be England alone. And England would, there will always be an England. It would survive. And, it you know, there's so much talent here and so many fantastic universities and so on. But really, out of the EU, with a Scottish border, we're surrounded by a European project that you don't like, that's exactly why England went to war against Napoleon or against Hitler or against the Spanish, you know.
Or further back against Louis XIV. I mean, the central aim of English and then British foreign policy since, Oh, I don't know.
It's,
I mean, it's at least the Spanish Armada is to stop Europe uniting against it and having no allies. I mean, this is why, I mean, in many ways, it was a failure of the Remain campaign, and we're all for liberal guilt on this programme. Liberals have lots to be guilty about, after all. But I mean, it is the most extraordinary unpatriotic act that the right has forced upon Britain. It goes against everything foreign policy for at least four centuries has strove to stop. To be fair, Tom Nairn, who was a very left-wing Scottish nationalist, has been writing this since the 70s. Mm-hmm. But the comparison that I've had lots of friends, including Scottish friends, make to me is with Austro-Hungary in 1918, where you have this glorious empire, this vast royal panoply. And meanwhile, the empire is just disintegrating into its constituent parts. And Vienna, for which read London, looks magnificent, but it's got no hinterland anymore.
I think that's right, and it doesn't have to be like this. That's a tragedy. I mean, it is true that Brexit has overturned 400 years of English foreign policy. There's no question about that. It seems to me. And I mean, how you repair that, I don't know. But England has got so many strengths and so many strengths locally. I mean, one of the reasons I say towards the end of the book, we federalized by stealth is because we have actually devolved in many ways over the past 50 years, not just given power to the Scots and the Welsh and so on, but actually we have devolved a lot of things that are very precious to us. And we could build on that. It is possible, but it would have to take a lot more imagination than is currently available in Westminster. And the biggest problem that we have of all is that that those who get into power in Westminster, and include the Labour Party as well, don't like to shake the ladder up which they have ascended. So there was a chance for Tony Blair to change things quite radically, and he didn't really do it. And now, do you think Boris Johnson's got any ideas of changing the way in which the constitution of the UK doesn't work? I don't think so, unfortunately, which is why, regrettably, I conclude that some of the worst cases might happen because we'll just bumble into it, because muddling through has become the destination, not just the modus operandi of this government.
Gavin, do you think that Scottish independence is, if we carry on as we are, inevitable? It's sort of become, if it's not quite there yet, it's sort of becoming the settled will of the Scottish people, and that, in that sense, once that happens, it doesn't really matter about the economic arguments or what currency you use or a huge dislocation, as happened in Ireland at the end of the second decade of the 20th century. People just said, we just don't want a part of this anymore.
I think obviously nothing's inevitable, but I do think it's likely, and it may take a decade, and it won't be easy, and there will be some quite horrendous problems. But I also think that Scotland would be welcomed within the European Union, because that has changed. We would not be leaving the European Union by seceding from England. The Scots would be a new accession state. And I think I've had discussions with friends in Ireland, in the Irish Republic, about whether they would vote, because they would have to vote, for Northern Ireland to join them. And many have reservations because they know that unionists can be difficult. I come from a unionist family in Northern Ireland too, and we are quite difficult people sometimes. But they all said to me, in the end, any Taoiseach, any Prime Minister of Ireland who had the chance of uniting Ireland would take it, no matter what it costs. And I suspect we're not at that tipping point quite in Scotland yet, but we may get there, and that Boris Johnson, by his incompetence, may help that process along quite a lot. I mean, if George Osborne said at the end of an article in the Evening Standard that the only way to stop the Scots getting independence is not to let them vote on it. Now, that is a real surrender of unionism. If that's all they've got, then I'm afraid it's not going to work.
Yes. Talking about Northern Irish unionists, Johnson has taught them one hell of a lesson. I mean, there always was a strain in unionism of a kind of suspicion of England and the English establishment. But to do what he's done must eventually cause a huge rethink in Ulster unionism, surely.
I think things go very slowly in Northern Ireland, and so they should. But who is telling them otherwise? I mean, Mrs. Thatcher was very clear. She was for the union. And there were politicians in the Conservative Party, John Biggs Davison and others, who were very, very staunch unionists. Going, and this sort of strand goes back to Kipling and Ulster 1912, his great poem, which I quote in the book. There isn't anybody who's really doing that now, and quite the opposite. I mean, the Louis de Bernier, as I mentioned before, he actually said if the Irish were only rational, they'd want to join basically some Anglo-Irish trading agreement. Well, I mean, apart from the kind of condescension implicit in that remark, the Irish are being perfectly rational in wanting to join what is the world's most successful trading bloc.
Oh, no. I mean, I remember, Gavin, I remember sort of the Irish right or far right, or I mean, actually not really, right's the wrong word, just Zoomer, as they'll call them in Scotland, commentators, and some English Conservatives predicting that, well, if we leave the EU, Ireland will have to do the same as well. I mean, it's just delusional. Look, we haven't got much time, so I'm just going to put something to you before recommending that people buy and read your book. Going through it, and I've noted it up, and you make your recommendations for home rule for different nations and PR and votes account and all things I agree with, I was scribbling down the side objections to why this wouldn't happen or couldn't happen or problem. And you sort of mentioned that earlier on. There is a feeling that when you and others, and you're hardly alone in this, put forward rational ways to reform the United Kingdom, to hold it together, that as soon as you mention them, they seem unworkable, which really does begin to look, as you were saying, that we're in some kind of failed state or a state that's heading towards failure. Is that fair?
I think you've put your finger on the core problem in all this. I've suggested ways in which we could reinvent the United Kingdom as it has been reinvented every century since 1603. But, you know, they're not going to sell because actually constitutional reform is boring. let's be honest. If I'm talking about, you know, getting rid of the House of Lords, which has been talked about for years, a proper PR system so that Westminster, you don't have 43% of the country voting for a Conservative government, which has got a majority of 80 seats, and giving more power back to local authorities, particularly the big cities in England. Now, I would stand over all of those kind of intellectually, but I admit that if I were to go around the country trying to sell it, nobody would turn up.
And in particular, if you try to sell it to politicians, not just Conservative politicians, they would say what you said, oh, this is boring. But they would also say, oh, well, you know, obviously I can see the theoretical case for getting rid of the House of Lords and having a second chamber as an assembly of the nations and interests and English regions and cities represented. But, you know, we want somewhere to put our backbenchers. We want somewhere to put our donors. It's incredibly difficult. The Lords will fight back. And I did, as someone, and I think this is a point that people who don't come from immigrant backgrounds understand, that immigrants and the descendants of immigrants are very, very keen on Britishness. They're very keen to say, yes, we're British, because that means that you can then say, well, Britain has always been multinational, multiracial. Englishness, Scottishness, Welshness, Irishness, it's just that bit more blood and soil. You either are or you aren't. And so, you know, I have long, you know, been an instinctive unionist, but it struck me very, very hard reading your book, particularly when I was trying to think hard questions to ask you. But these sensible, necessary reforms, I can just see the opposition, how entrenched it would be, and the interest. I did get a feeling that this can't last, from your book, even though that was exactly the impression you didn't want to give, because you wanted to say, as do many others, there are ways out of this.
Yes, I wanted to challenge nationalists, as I say, for how difficult it will be, but also unionists for what are we going to look like. And I agree with you that the word British has been in the past much more inclusive. I think it's less so in Scotland now. And, you know, I say in the book, I know Sikhs who wear Scottish tartans, and they're Asian Scottish. That's how, or Scottish Asians. That's how they see themselves. So I think the word British still applies to people of colour in England, perhaps, because they don't choose to see themselves as English. And if you read Afia Hirsch's work, she says, that's because English, white English people don't see me completely as English either. So, I mean, don't take it from me, take it from people who experience what it's like. Yeah. You know, I'm a middle-aged white guy. But if you ask particularly younger people of color, do you see themselves as English? There may be some, I'm sure there are some, but many actually see themselves as British instead, as you say.
Right, Gavin, that has been absolutely fantastic, if not hugely cheering. So all that remains for me to do is to thank Gavin very much for taking the time and trouble to be with us, and to say The Bunker is on daily, Monday through Friday. Tuesday is a bumper edition. If you like this, please consider subscribing to Patreon. You pay a bit of money and get all kinds of goodies and treats. And if that is too much for you, just write some nice comment on your Android or Apple podcast provider and say how great we are. Thank you so much for being with us, and I will be back soon.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Nick Cohen. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich. An audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.